It should be plenty.
House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Wednesday, May 6th. First item on the agenda, we'll open a public hearing, possible work session on Senate Bill 839.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Senate Bill 839A comes to this committee from Senators Bates, Cruz, and Steiner Hayward, and Representatives Williamson, Fagan, Peluso, Taylor, and Wilson. The bill immunizes people from arrest or prosecution for certain drug offenses when evidence is obtained in response to a request for medical assistance. It prohibits law enforcement from arresting persons for violating supervision when the evidence is obtained in response to a request for medical assistance. And it prohibits law enforcement from arresting persons on certain Oregon warrants when the person is discovered after a request for medical assistance. There's no amendments. There's no revenue impact. There is a minimal fiscal impact, and the bill is ready to move. It passed out of the Senate 26-4.
Okay. Senator, please.
What we're talking about is this is the expansion of a bill we passed, I think, in 11. And at that time, we knew that if you – Senator Bates, District 3, I'm sorry. Senator Bates, District 3, Southern Oregon. To continue, we know that when people are overdosed on opiates, we could reverse that quickly and easily with either a nasal spray or an injection. Frankly, as a physician, I've used it IV on patients more than the other way, and it's pretty spectacular. You have someone who's overdosed. They're going to stop breathing pretty quickly, and you give them the Narcan IV. They wake up immediately. It's not a pleasant experience. They don't like it, but they wake up. They start breathing again. You can save their brain. You can save their lives. And so this is really about saving lives. What we can do is out in the field, when people are down that way, who is usually around them is not just an EMT if someone gets called. It's usually other people, frankly, who are using drugs. And this gives them the ability to start doing this for the person who's down. And when the police do arrive, the EMT's alive, they don't get arrested because they're there for some drug problems themselves. They have some immunity, but it's all based on their own use of drugs. After we passed the first bill, at that time, Oregon was number one in the nation for drug overdose deaths, number one in the nation. And it started dropping precipitously. Because the program is in place here, we have been noted to be the best state for improvement in this area. And people are coming to this state to see what the heck did Oregon do to go from number one to number 37. This huge drop in deaths from this. And it's because of this bill. Primarily, they're not the one in front of you, the one previously. We're going to expand it with this bill if you support us, and I believe we can drive this down even further. And it gives you an opportunity for people to change their lives. It is not uncommon when someone has this experience of overdosing themselves, and it's usually accidental, and having what I call the Narcan experience, which is not fun. And then get into a hospital and get on a respirator or whatever we need, because we have to keep giving the drug. It only works for about 15 minutes. They go through the whole process. They are much more likely to go into a situation where they're going to go to rehab and get clean of drugs and have an opportunity to have a real life. So this is about saving lives from my point of view at the point where you need to do it and getting these people into treatment and saving those lives and have an opportunity for these people who are of all different ages, many of them are young people, but not all, to go on and have a good life. It's a real opportunity, and I'm very happy to support this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Jennifer Williamson. I represent House District 36. The senator mentioned the 2013 bill, Senate Bill 384, that allowed non-medical professionals to have Narcan, naloxone. And in my own district, there's a program called Outside In. They do needle exchanges. And I've been there probably twice since we passed that bill. And I literally have met people who are still alive because we passed that bill. And it is an incredibly moving experience to have people come up and say, because my friend, when we did a needle exchange, was trained on how to use Narcan, I overdosed. She administered Narcan, and I'm alive. And so, you don't get to do that very much in this building, where you know that we passed a bill and there are people alive because of it. And so the ability to expand this, I think, is vital, because when people, as the senator said, when people are using together, to be too scared to call for medical help has got to be a horrible place to be. And so to just have that, when people go to things like needle exchanges, the ability to share the information that, by the way, you know, we want you to get help, but if you're not going to get help, you should know that, you know, if you end up in a medical emergency, you can call. And I think it will make a big difference. In Multnomah County, in the first 6 months after we passed the Narcan bill, overdoses, the death by overdose dropped 44% in Multnomah County. I mean, it had a huge impact. And so like I said, Senate Bill 384 was one of the best things I've ever worked on in any legislative field as a lobbyist or as a legislator, and I'm really excited to be able to expand it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, State Representative Shamia Fagan from House District 51. And when you hear my testimony, you'll think that perhaps Senator Bates and I actually coordinated beforehand, but we did not. But as he was talking, I thought, well, I'm going to tell a story that's going to echo a couple of the comments that he made. I've already appeared before this committee and let you know that my mom passed away in October, but that is actually the good news. It could have been a lot worse, because 6 years prior to when she passed away was roughly January of 2009, and I was a third-year law student enjoying my last week of Christmas break when I got a call from my mom's boss to let me know that my mom was in the ICU at Portland Adventist. And she had overdosed on a variety of opiates, but heroin and other things. And the exact situation that we're trying to address in this bill had almost taken her life 6 years prior, because she was, you know, with her spouse at the time and a couple other people. They were obviously, you know, doing drugs, and they knew that she had OD'd. And she went unconscious, but they were afraid to call the police because they were afraid that they were going to get in trouble. He had some outstanding warrants. And the only reason she actually got to the hospital was because his brother, they lived with my mom's father-in-law at the time, and my mom's brother-in-law happened to stop by the next morning, saw that my mom was unconscious, and asked her spouse what had happened. And he said, oh, we can't wake her up. And so he called the ambulance. Otherwise, if he hadn't stopped by that morning, literally to return a spatula, she wouldn't have made it, because they wouldn't have called the police or the ambulance. So this bill literally, you know, in that situation would, you know, have saved a life. And as Senator Bates said, this was a life-changing experience for my mom. That was her last instance. She went on for the next almost 6 years being clean and sober before she passed away in October. So very supportive of this bill, just because I lived through a situation that actually could have been a lot worse, but for needing to return a spatula. So very much supportive that we need to make sure that there's every incentive to call emergency professionals when somebody's life is in danger. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Bovet, legal counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties, here today representing AOC as well as the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Both organizations are in strong support of this bill. I just thought I'd walk you through real briefly what the bill does. I was the primary scrivener of the bill, so I thought I'd just kind of explain it. As explained by the previous legislators, the purpose really is to remove the disincentives to call in an overdose. Subsection 1 does that by granting immunity from arrest for the person who calls it in. In the example given by Representative Fagan, it would have been her mother's spouse. In subsection 2, it gives immunity for arrest for the specified offenses in subsection 3 to the person who is actually undergoing the overdose, to remove that disincentive as well. Subsection 4 removes the disincentive for calling for those that would be in violation of their own pretrial release for pending charges. Subsection 4 also deals with probation and parole violations, outstanding PVs that could cause people to be arrested and also be a disincentive for people calling in. And subsection 5 deals with outstanding warrants that are in the system. Some technical things that I borrowed from other state statutes that I examined on these issues, dealing with the issue of suppression of evidence as well as not being able to ignore federal warrants, which causes other entanglements that we don't need to get into, and really it's just such a small subset that it shouldn't cause a problem. So that's the structure of the bill. I'm happy to answer any questions. Again, District Attorney's Association as well as AOC is in support of this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Fagan, thank you for sharing that story. I'm
sure that's not easy. Whomever, it doesn't really matter to me which person maybe can answer this, but I think you answered it already, but I want to make sure, I just underlined it to make sure I understood, because I'm, you know, tough on crime guy, but I certainly understand addictions and these issues surrounding that, and man, I want people to get help. So my question would be, does the immunity apply only to the caller, so in like your story situation, just the caller, or does it, if in the group of there were four, five, or six, or whatever people, would it apply to them as well? Does that make sense?
Maybe I can answer that. Yeah. Chair Barker, Representative Post, it applies to the caller, and it would apply to the person undergoing the overdose if they were making the call, but it would not apply to everyone else in the building or
okay.
in the room.
Follow up?
Yeah,
okay, so then if you came to – so somebody comes to the situation because of the call – they see four or five people, maybe they're not passed out, but pretty bad shape, pretty obvious there's something. The caller is exempt, or is that the right word? Immune. Maybe the other words. You know, I'm not trying to come in and do a big drug bust, but do you see what I'm seeing? Do you kind of see where I'm going with that?
Yeah, I do. Chair Barker, Representative Post. So here's how it works as a practical matter on the street. If you're undergoing, if somebody's undergoing an overdose and they're with one friend, then that friend's going to need to make the call and stay there because the 911 needs them to stay there.
Mm-hmm.
If they're with a bunch of friends, the disincentive is for nobody to call. What this bill would do was we'd give safe harbor for someone to stay with them. Everybody else can run. They can flee.
Okay.
So what the problem is we want to take away the disincentive to call, but we also want to take away the incentive to run. And so we're building in an incentive for somebody to stay.
Okay, great. Thank you.
I would just say I've seen more than once in Portland where the fire service has come out and injected somebody who was dead. Mm-hmm. And they were gone. And the first time I saw that, I couldn't believe it. And the person got up and said, "I'm fine." And they insisted, we insisted they go to the hospital. And they said, you have to tell them you were dead 2 minutes ago.
You're going to be again in 15
45 minutes.
Minutes
right. Things aren't going to be, you won't be feeling so good. But anyway, it's a great lifesaver. This bill will help. Thank you. Thank you, panel. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee.
Paul Haven and Michelle.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, thank you for having us here this afternoon. My name's Paul Lewis. I'm the public health officer for Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties, and I'm here to testify in support of this bill, sometimes called the Good Samaritan bill. And as Rob mentioned, it's intended to encourage bystanders to not only call but to stay around and provide aid while EMS arrives without fearing that they're going to be arrested for a carefully selected list of offenses, mostly minor. And as you know, unfortunately, Oregon and the rest of the country are grappling with the surge in overdose deaths. The number we like to quote between in the decade of the 2000s, we had a doubling in our overdose deaths, and overdose deaths far exceed deaths from car crashes now. So again, just a good sort of comparison, something we worry a lot about. And as the previous panel mentioned, a prompt treatment with the drug naloxone, as you say, can bring people literally back to life. And there's two ways that can happen. The program that Haven's going to discuss is about the previous session and the ability for lay people to own and give the medication. But if that's not available, EMS all has it on the rigs. And as soon as they can get there, it can be given. So either way, it's really important that EMS be called. You might wonder, why are people worried? Well, it's not an irrational fear, because especially in less urban areas, law enforcement is often the first to arrive at the scene, not necessarily EMS. And as you may also be aware, law enforcement agencies have enthusiastically thought about how to get trained in the use of this medication as well. Now, the police aren't there to make arrests. They're there in their life safety role. And in fact, it's very rare for arrests to happen. So what we really have is a perception problem among the people who might or might not call. The needle exchange program in the Portland metro area does surveys of the people who go there to exchange needles. And in a recent survey, 39% said that they wouldn't call 911 because of fear of arrest. And a similar survey done in 2011 in Seattle asked the question slightly differently, but 90% said they would be more likely to call 911 if there were a Good Samaritan law. This kind of law is also not a radical thing. 24 other states in the District of Columbia all have Good Samaritan laws. I also want to point out, we don't think that naloxone alone or the Good Samaritan alone are the answers to all of our problems with opiates. And we want to reassure you they were taking a very comprehensive top-to-bottom approach to this, with naloxone being at one end, bringing people back to life, and at the other end, trying to prevent misuse and everything in between, including addiction treatment, et cetera. So thank you for your time this afternoon.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm Haven Wheelock. I am the program coordinator for the syringe exchange at Outside In, mentioned earlier. In 2013, the legislature took the important first step to get naloxone into the hands of people who need it. And the day that that law went into effect and started, Outside In began distributing naloxone to our constituents. We've currently, just at Outside In, have trained over 1,100 individuals. And we have been seeing a reduction in heroin-related deaths in Multnomah County. With this program, anytime someone uses their naloxone, we encourage them to come back and tell us about what happens. We track, you know, the number of reversals, things like that. As of this morning, we were at 665 overdoses reported back to us having been reversed. And when they bring this information to us, we ask them a bunch of questions about the outcome and about what happened, different things. And only about a third of people who are reporting overdoses to us report that 911 was called at the scene of the overdose. Two-thirds, it's not getting called. And the number one reason they tell us that they don't call 911 is because they say they're afraid of the police and they don't want to interact with law enforcement. We've only had 5 people of all of those report that anyone was ever arrested at the scene of an overdose. So it's pretty rare that someone would actually get arrested, but people are worried about that. I'm very proud of the success we've had in Portland around naloxone and around overdose, but in the majority of the state currently, the only way to get naloxone is by calling 911. In most of the state, I think we may be one of the only programs distributing to people happening currently in our states, the county health department in Portland. So this is an issue that is across the state, and this law will allow people to get people the help that they need sooner. Just a few weeks ago, I had a man drive his overdosing friend to the syringe exchange, come in, knock on my door while I was in a meeting, pull me out of a meeting because his friend was overdosing and he was scared to make the call. He helped me pull his friend out of his car onto the sidewalk and then left because he was scared that he would get in trouble. Luckily, that gentleman was fine, and I applaud him for at least bringing him to me and not leaving him somewhere else. But had I not been there, how much time would have last before he actually did make that call or took him to a hospital? This law is not going to change how law enforcement interacts in these situations. They're there to do the right thing, but people need to not be scared, and they need to have that incentive to make those calls. So thank you for your time.
My name is Michelle Chisholm, and I'm here today in favor of having a Good Samaritan law. I don't have statistics as to how many lives were lost, but I have a personal story to share. 4 years ago this month, my son witnessed a friend having an overdose. He and his friends did everything they could to try to save her. They did everything except call 911. They eventually called 911, but it was too late, and she passed away. And I'll never forget the sadness and remorse that I heard in my son's voice when he told me what had happened. I couldn't comprehend why he wouldn't have called 911. In my mind, it would be the first and foremost thing that I would do in an event like that. But I kept asking and asking, and all he could reply to me was that we didn't know what to do. We were afraid. So in the days and weeks that followed this, I saw him sink into a deeper depression, and I saw him spiral down deeper and deeper into his addiction. A month and a half later, my son overdosed on heroin. The friend that he was with fled the scene and called 911 after and placed an anonymous call. But by the time the paramedics arrived there, it was too late. My son Travis passed away at the age of 22 on July 14th. Now, every time I hear in the news about another overdose, my heart just breaks that another life was lost. And my heart just breaks thinking of the family and the grieving process that they will go through. I'll never know if calling 911 immediately would have saved Travis's life or if it would have saved his friend's life. But I know that time matters, and I know that his life mattered too. I know that nothing will bring him back, and nothing will bring his friend back. And since his death 4 years ago, I vowed that I'll do everything I could to try to turn this tragic event into something positive. As I was coming here today, leaving my office, I walked outside and there was a really dark, dark cloud just hanging over our office. But behind it, I saw bright sunshine, and it really made me think of that saying, behind every cloud, there's a silver lining. And it was just ironic. And I thought that this could be the silver lining to help families out there. So I ask for your support in passing this bill. Thank you.
And thank you very much for sharing that story. And you know how difficult that is, and but really appreciate you coming down and putting a human face on it. So thank you. Are there any questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mary O. Parker Milligar and Ed Johnston.
Thank you. Chair Barker, Vice Chairs Williamson and Olson, and members of the committee, my name is Mario Parker Milligan. I'm the Legislative Director for the Oregon Student Association. OSA represents over 120,000 students in Oregon's community colleges and public universities. We were established in 1975 to represent and serve and protect the collective interests of students across the state, which our mission has us focused on electoral organizing, such as registering students to vote, engaging those same students in the legislative process, surveying them on issues that impact them, and advocating for their issues like we're doing here today. Sometimes the advocacy is directly related to the cost of college, and oftentimes we advocate for policy that improves the quality of education and safety of students. And this is why we are in full support of Senate Bill 839 today. We are most pleased to see the legislature expand on this issue of medical amnesty with this legislation. Students last brought forth similar legislation in 2014 with Representative Doherty with House Bill 4049. That was limited to minors facing medical emergencies related to alcohol poisoning. Far too many individuals forego seeking medical assistance out of fear they will get in trouble or face repercussions. This is unnecessary. We believe we need to ensure that people are able to access medical help without this fear, and we believe this bill goes a long way to do just that. So we urge your support for Senate Bill 839 and ask that you pass it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. And first off, I'd like to say I'm standing here with the 1789 ratified Constitution. Let me finish. I'm having severe medical issues, and this is talking about drugs and the bills. I just said that. Let me just finish what I'm saying. Now, December 21st, a friend of mine, all right, that I known for 33 years, just like me, the doctors say you're not entitled to pain medication, you're not entitled to have medication in the state of Oregon, you're supposed to die. And I can prove this. I have evidence publicized in the newspapers, articles, and stuff I've turned in the House and Senate. And it's very disturbing when we talk about this, and it frustrates me because where is the personal responsibility of all of us? Where is the personal responsibility? We're supposed to be not only educating ourselves, but our children not going down this path. Okay? I mean, I grew up in the streets, San Francisco, around here in Oregon. All right? I witnessed all this stuff myself. I've been through the ups and downs, but I've never been into it in the drug part because it's personal responsibility and liability. All right? And I have an Inspector General's report, 2006, from the Department of Justice, clarifies and states that the Senate and House have a copy. All right? It is personal liability. And it's frustrating we're not educating our children and our school staff through this on liability issues and personal responsibility. It's very disturbing that we talk about the drug issues. And everybody's accused of being a drug addict. Okay? Now, when they call in, because I own my body, not the state. And so when they call in, the state will pick me up and do anything they want with my body. When I die, and believe me, I'm severe medical. My lungs are filled up. Everybody knows what's going on. The House of Senate's got my medical for the last 20 years up here since my neck was broken on a job. And everybody knows I worked 7 years with a broken neck. And I fought with workman's comp on these bills. And the thing is that it's so disturbing that responsibility is not taught. All right? And we have an oath of office that I would like to know what oath everybody's taking, because you know, when men and women are supposed to die, even like what these people are complaining, like the one lady said about her son with the OD, all right, where's the responsibility with the people? How come they're not taught that in school? Oregon state law says that they're supposed to know the Constitution and contract law before they get high school educated, and that's in the Oregon state Constitution for the funding of the schools. Okay. And it was really disturbing that the responsibility of these things that of our education that we're supposed to be educating ourselves and the children are not taught.
Thank you.
And I'm turning this in for evidence so you understand that it's been in the paper, especially with Lincoln County, with the attempts, and with my house been robbed by the cops and everything else.
Okay, thank you. Close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 839.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 839A to the floor with the due pass.
Representative Williamson moves Senate Bill 839A. To the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
I want to carry it.
You want to carry it? Okay. Representative Williamson, carry the bill, please. Okay. Next item on. What's that?
Representative Fagan, maybe?
I'll talk to her.
Yeah. Okay. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 377.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Senate Bill 377A comes to this committee from the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary. The bill modifies Oregon's computer crime statute to specifically include theft of an intimate image as prohibited conduct. The bill declares an emergency and is effective upon passage. There is one amendment before the committee. It is the proposed -A3 amendment. It would keep the underlying bill but add an unrelated concept. Specifically, it would reorder the general conditions of probation under Oregon's probation condition statute. The fiscals are in on this bill with the dash A3 amendment. There is a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact. Passed out of the Senate with a 30-0 vote.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Barker, can I ask counsel a question
before
we even get started? I was reading this today, going through it over and over and over, and I kept coming up with, it sounds so much like at least one or two bills that we passed out of the House, and I know that that can happen, but is there a big difference between this and the couple others that were real similar?
And so, Chair Barker, Representative Post, this bill filled a gap when we had our hearing in the Senate on Senate Bill 188, which is the dissemination of an intimate image bill. We had a hearing in this committee on that, I think, about a week ago. And so when we heard testimony in the Senate on that bill, we heard a story, which I think we'll probably hear this afternoon, about a scenario where someone had their image stolen, not disseminated, but just stolen from the device, and the response from law enforcement was that wasn't prosecutable as an offense because there was arguably the image didn't have any value and the theft statutes wouldn't apply. So that's, this bill came out of a discussion about the dissemination of an intimate image bill that we've already heard. Then there were, of course, the other privacy bills.
I guess I was thinking the upskirting one.
Yeah.
This I think is, if I may, the case I cited where somebody took their laptop in to get it repaired, and then somebody took
the pictures. Yeah, I remember that one too. So that's different.
Yeah.
Than
that wasn't covered in those others, so this picks that up.
Okay, I guess I'm trying to say, is there a way of, or are these three separate topics we're talking here then?
They're closely related, but they needed to be spelled out separately.
Okay. So,
okay. Jeremiah Stromberg, Aaron Knott, and Christina Gordon.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Department of Justice, here in support of Senate Bill 377. And just to talk a little bit about how we got here, last week you heard Senate Bill 188, as counsel indicated, that prohibited the unlawful dissemination of an intimate image. And the Department of Justice put that bill together with the help of OCDLA, ACLU, and ODA during the interim. What that targeted was when pictures were taken consensually, usually within a romantic relationship, and then they were later uploaded without the consent of the person depicted. In the process of generating that bill, I heard Christina Gordon's story, which was about, and she'll tell you, but it didn't fit into the what we had put together. Basically, she had pictures stolen. It wasn't a question of consent or non-consent. They were actually just stolen from a portable electronic device. And I was surprised when I went back and looked at the statute, because we do have a statutory infrastructure already, which makes it a crime to steal things off of computers. But it presumes that that item would be something of value. And the definition of value that's been applied by the Court of Appeals is pretty narrow and has to actually be sort of commercial exchange value like we see in the theft statutes. And when the Department of Justice looked at it, and I think this is something about which reasonable minds could certainly differ, we felt that likely that couldn't be applied to the theft of a photo or an intimate image, no matter what it depicted. So at the direction of the chair and the other committee, we put our heads together and put this together, which is a targeted attempt to deal with a fact pattern that I'm fairly confident is not covered right now in Oregon law, which is when an intimate image is taken from a computer, a telephone, or another electronic device. So I'm open for any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Knott?
Chair Barker, members of the Judiciary Committee, thanks again for having me. My name is Christina Gordon. As Aaron was saying, last week I shared my story, and the framework of my case didn't necessarily fit the frame for Senate Bill 188, but it doesn't mean that I didn't want that shared and, you know, contributed to part of the story. But so what had happened in my case is the manager had taken my phone. It was lying about. Took my phone, plugged it into a computer, took all of the photos, and then ended up sharing those with other employees and I don't know who else. So, and when I did go to the police department, just as Aaron was saying, there's not a monetary value, which I think we could all argue philosophically, because I feel like that was priceless. So I think it's really necessary, especially going back to Chair Barker's story about when you went to the computer repair shop. And this could happen all the time. It probably happens a lot more than we think it does. Even the cases in Hollywood, the Jennifer Lawrence, and I think it was seven other celebrities. Their images were taken from, I think, their cloud service and then shared. So it's kind of a tool for exploitation. And the person who stole my photos, it wasn't with the intent to humiliate or harass me. It was to exploit bragging rights. Look what I have. Touchy things like that. So I think that this is a really necessary bill. I think you will find that it will be pretty applicable once it becomes law. And it did pass the Senate unanimously, bipartisan support. Love this building. So I'm open to taking any questions. I think that's all I have there.
Thank you. Anybody have any questions? Thank you again for coming back again.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeremiah Stromberg, Assistant Director with the Department of Corrections. And thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of Senate Bill 377. Specifically, I'm here to discuss the probation condition amendments that are now a part of this bill. The amendments before you represent a correction to the numbering of general conditions of probation. Since the beginning of supervision in Oregon, the general conditions have been the same for both parole and probation. Parole conditions can be found in ORS 144.102 and probation in 137.540. In addition, they have been numbered the same to prevent confusion for parole officers, the courts, and the Board of Parole. House Bill 3194 added a new probation condition of supervision for probation only. And it was to submit to a risk and needs assessment as directed by the supervising officer. This new condition was inadvertently added into the middle of the list.
Hold on 1 second,
Jeremy. Maybe.
I think we're on the wrong bill. This was about the computer crimes?
No, Chair Barker, okay. I can clarify here.
Thank you.
I mean, I was getting confused.
So, yes, I'm not tracking. This was my first foray into the relating clause scenario.
Okay. Okay.
This bill had a relating to crime.
You did tell me about.
And this is a technical fix. This is a stuff, not a gut and stuff. This is adding a technical fix. I'm sorry for not making that clear to everyone from the beginning.
Like, how do we get from computers to parole officers?
Sure. I apologize as well for the confusion on that. In essence, we have ended up with two separate numbering systems for the conditions of parole versus the conditions of probation. This causes extreme difficulty for our courts, our parole officers, for the Board of Parole, and again for the Department of Corrections' antiquated and aged computer system unable to manage two separate numbering systems of conditions. House Bill 3194 added a new condition that resulted in this change, and so what is before you is merely a renumbering so that our probation and parole conditions can remain the same. And I certainly apologize and don't want to take away from the seriousness of this, the essence of this bill, but I appreciate your consideration and us being able to correct this numbering system for our supervision practices. And I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Yes, thank you. Sorry for the confusion. I was warned and I got away from me. Thank you, panel.
Okay, Ed.
Please, I I'm telling you, you know, you have to stay closely to the bill. If you don't, you're not going to ever speak in this committee.
Well, I'm going to stay closely to the bill. What's concerning to me, the way this bill appears, is the back door into the Fourth Amendment rights. We already have Fourth Amendment rights. And when we go through this, when somebody taking your information, you can file a criminal charge. Now, what I'm understanding is everybody's saying that the police department has to do this, so now it's becoming a commercial statement instead of public safety, because they could make their own decision of however they want to be able to take somebody's assets and resources through that, filing charges and instruments through a district attorney. That this is a backdoor into your Fourth Amendment rights that is going to destroy it. Now, we already have stuff in place. Please, let's relook at our laws that we have in place and re-go by that. And I like to make it for public record. 21 days to let the public know what oath. Because it is very frustrating when you get attacked, insult, especially like this. I mean, my name is, my pictures are all posted because I stood up in front of a cop, and so I've already lost $40,000, and my name's posted all over YouTube and everything else, and they get away with it?
We're talking about...
I understand. Okay. It has effect to it. Okay. Thank you, and also, too, thank you for respecting the First Amendment right.
Okay. Close the public hearing. Open a work session on Senate Bill 377A.
Mr. Chair, I move the A3 amendments into Senate Bill 377A.
Representative Williams moves the -3 amendments into Senate Bill 377A.
I don't want to gum up the works, but I haven't seen this. I thought somebody said it, they weren't ready yet.
No, they're ready. They're.
This is the part about
the DAs.
Parole and probation system.
They have a number, so the way it's set up now is confusing. You can't match A to 3 and B to 5, and so this just straightens out. It's a technical fix.
But it's an addition.
We had to drop it in because the relating clause was
okay.
Relating
to so it's just an addition to the other portion that we heard testimony about.
Yep.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I do just want to comment. And I've had a lot of experience with playing with relating to clauses, as I'm sure you know, over my 7 terms. But this really produces a bill. I don't have any problem with either half of it. It seems fine. But they're really two very different things, even though they come under crime. And
that's right.
That makes it it shouldn't make it hard to vote on, because one is completely innocuous and the other is completely good. But we ought to be a little cautious, won't we?
We are. This was, you know, once again, timeline, and we had to find a related clause.
I don't have a problem.
We're searching
for
another one on a different issue, too. But
well, how could you get anything broadly related to crime? You get one on my committee. I have one relating to health.
Just related.
Yeah.
Usually we don't have those.
My first term, I had a relating to crime bill. That is a mistake that you make one time.
Related guns is another one. So, okay. Are there any objections to the -3s going in? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 377A as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Williams moves Senate Bill 377A to the floor with the due pass, as amended to the floor with the due pass. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Could my Harvard lawyer explain this one on the floor?
You need to carry this.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 199.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Senate Bill 199A came to this committee from the Office of the Governor. The bill has no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal impact, and what it does is there is a rarely used but existing provision, ORS 144.122 and 144.126, which authorizes the Board of Parole to release a prisoner early if certain criteria are met, whereby it would be cruel or inhumane to keep the person incarcerated. This is a rarely used provision, primarily in end-of-life situations, and it had no victim notification provision. And so what this bill does is require that prior to any release hearing or administrative decision, the victim be notified. Parole Board had contacted me. I don't believe anyone has signed up to testify on the bill. They did submit written testimony. It is ready to move. It has all the paperwork in.
And this is the person that they're dying. They put in hospice. Right. Okay. This will allow, if the victim is asked for notification, they'd be notified.
That's right.
And just correct me if I'm wrong, but that is currently the situation. Generally speaking, the victim has to opt in to notification from parole board. It's not default, right?
That's correct. And this matches that language, where they opt in and then they are notified.
Okay. Open a work session on Senate Bill 199.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 199A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves Senate Bill 199A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Anybody like to carry that? Representative Krieger will carry. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 350.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Senate Bill 350A comes to this committee from the Senate Interim Judiciary Committee. This bill has no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact. It passed the Senate 30-0. And this bill exists because of a change in population. I don't believe there's anyone signed up to testify on this.
I don't.
Okay. What this bill does is there are two sets of timelines for filing a motion to disqualify a judge for trial. One set of timelines applies to counties with populations 100,000 or less. They have 10 days after the judicial assignment to file their motion. If it's greater than 100,000 people, you have to file the motion at the time of the assignment. That was enacted in 1995. Since then, four counties have grown beyond 100,000 people. What this bill does is allow counties with a population between 100,000 and 200,000 to elect which set of timelines they want to follow. It is ready to move.
Good afternoon again. I'm living this personally with Judge.
Say your name, please.
Huh?
Say your name.
Oh, my given name is Ed Johnston, for record. My website's Oregon Trackers, and we have the United States of America Republic, Elected and Public Service Oversight. I'm dealing with this with Judge Branford in my community. We're less than 100,000, but this is going to put it away for judges just put a motion in and keep somebody in jail and keep them out. Okay, I've seen what the bill does, and it's scary. This is taking away our constitutional rights and putting it into a judge's hand. And if you look at the history of this, the federal and state laws, we have maritime courts. Judges don't have authority. And I have it filed with the committee here, the actual federal laws and the state administration rules of the state of Oregon on this. And it's scary when we got judges, because I got a judge right now that I'm supposed to go to trial June 19th because I walked down the street and proved that municipalities cannot write warrants. That's the state of Oregon and federal law. The Supreme Court has stated that is part of this bill because it's going to give a judge authority that he can supersede somebody's lawful rights, not legal. There's a difference of lawful and legal. And so this could supersede somebody's legal rights. And this is what is disturbing to me, because I'm living through this where with a judge that I'm dealing with was part of destroying my family in 2004. And that was all filed in this House of Senate on the investigation committee, and nothing ever turned out. And then when the federal government got involved, they determined the mayor and city council and others were personally involved, discrediting me, and even tried to take me out. The Department of Justice put it in writing.
Okay.
So I can see that this could be misused completely by municipalities. And so municipalities don't have lawful legal authority, neither do the cities.
Okay.
And so anyhow, I appreciate your time, and I'll turn some further evidence, and I'll email it to you guys so it's on record so it gets filed into the circumstances. And as the Supreme Court says, police departments don't work for the people. They work for the mayor and city council, or collection agents for the states. So, you know, it's not being disrespectful, but we'd like to see them honoring their oath to the lawful Americans. Okay. You know, if we start honoring our oath, we can reduce crime rates so fast. Anyhow, I appreciate your time.
Thank you for your time.
Have a wonderful afternoon, gentlemen.
And close public hearing, Senate Bill 350.
377, actually.
I'm sorry, thank you.
Or no, this
is no, 350.
Oh, my mistake, sorry.
Yeah. And open a work session on Senate Bill 350.
Okay, so, Mr. Chair, I move, is ready to go?
Yeah.
Okay, Senate Bill 350A to the House floor with due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson moves House Bill 350A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. All right, is there any discussion? Yes.
I have a question at council. Do we have any idea which way the counties are going to go?
They're going to want to follow the existing practice.
They're going to, i.e., the 10 days?
Yeah. I know from Chair Barker, Representative Barton, I know from the discussion, at least on the Senate side, this came out of a situation in Douglas County. I know there are four counties. I listed Douglas.
Deschutes, Yamhill, yeah. Douglas, maybe Lynn?
And so Houston, anecdotally, Lynn, Douglas, what I know is Douglas, at least, would prefer to follow the 10-day procedure. I don't know about the others.
Question, why don't we simply change the rather basically what we're doing is we're creating a third category, 100 to 200, and making it optional. Why don't we just raise the limit from 100 to 200? And basically, it just seems simpler.
And then they wouldn't have to.
Yeah, but it would preserve the status quo.
And I, Representative Barton, I don't know. This direction came from the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, so. I wasn't a part of any work group discussion, but I think they wanted to give flexibility. You
know. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm from the State Court Administrator's Office. It's not our bill, but I know some of the history on it. And Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, I think the reason they went to the middle ground was that a couple of the counties have been following the other statute for quite some time, and if you lift the limit up to 200,000, then, for example, Deschutes with 165 would have to change their procedure. This way, those smaller counties, as they go up to 100,000, will have their choice which statute to follow, and the other counties that are in between 100 and 200,000, you know, if they've already gone to the second statute, 14.270, they can continue with it.
We're in a work session. Do you have any, are there any objections to the motion? Seeing none, so ordered. He's got one. Representative Leininger, this sounds like a good lawyer.
Okay, thank you. Chair Barker, when you're done, may I?
You got to close the work session.
Bill passes. Work session is closed. Representative Leininger will carry.
Thank you. And Chair Barker, may I also move that we suspend the rules and allow Representative Olson to vote on Senate Bill 377?
Sure. Is there any objections to the rule suspension? Representative Olson, how do you vote?
Yes.
Representative Olson votes aye. Thank you. Okay. No further business. We are adjourned. Thank you for objecting.
What are you doing there?
We are adjourned. Thank you, Jack.